28, 1987, Bob Steck interviewing Paul Rebillard. That's capital R-E-B-I-L-L-A-R-D, Paul. Is there a middle name?
Ernest.
And would you spell that?
E-R-N-E-S-T.
Right, thank you. All right, Paul, then we'll start in terms of what labor was like, the general picture of the area.
Well, we had talked recently about the ice industry, which was a very necessary industry back 50, 60, 70 years ago. And it, although it's a fairly familiar subject, there's some things about it which the people today don't fully understand. The first, of course, was the absolute necessity to harvest ice, because there was no such thing as a refrigerator. Ice boxes, yes, but to make an ice box work, you need ice. To get ice was a brutally hard labor involved affair, which took place in midwinter necessarily, because we had to wait until the ice was thick enough to harvest. And by thick enough, I would think between 12 and 14 to 16 inches was regarded as probably thick enough to begin the ice harvest. The first thing, of course, you had to do was go to the lake or pond where you were going to harvest the ice, select a site, and mark it out. This marking was done by a horse-drawn plow affair, which was an implement with a serrated teeth at the bottom and about 6 feet long, quite heavy, had to be heavy in order to hold itself in place. So this instrument was placed on the lake and drawn by a horse in a straight line. It was essential to have a straight line so we'd end up with square cakes, or at least not square cakes, but equal, but regular rectangular cakes.
How did you fix that straight line?
Well, that was up to the horse and the man. Usually, the way I saw it done, a man led the horse, and then the man stood back with his instrument with handles like a plow handles, and he guided, held the plow, the ice plow, upright, and the horse pulled it, and was led by a man, and he proceeded in an absolute straight line. As I say, that was essential to get a straight line. Having plowed a good straight line to a depth of perhaps 6 inches deep, then the plow had a guide with a handle which flipped over. So now you flip it over from the original line that you have plowed in the ice, and drop this guide into that line, and then as you come back, you follow the same line. This guide proceeds down the slot that you've cut in the ice, so therefore now you have two straight lines. When you get to the other end, you just flip the guide over into the last plow mark you've made, and you proceed until you've made the required number of straight lines across. That accounts for the line one way. Now, of course, you start on the other side and go mm-hmm. 180 degrees across these two lines in a nice straight line as you did the first one. And if you've gotten yourself a nice straight line, then you proceed back and forth, continually flipping the guide over the slot you just made. The result is a checkerboard, perfectly formed checkerboard of slots, approximately 6 inches deep, when you have marked out the required number of cakes that you require, either for a day's harvest or 2 days or whatever, now your ice field is marked out. And the average size of the cakes, as I recall, would be about 12 by 18 or 12 by 16 inches. In other words, something that a man could handle. Mm-hmm. Having gotten your field all plowed out, then you opened it, which required, of course, chopping down through the ice and producing an opening down through the ice into the water so that you could proceed to begin to take the cakes off. Once you've got the field opened and you have open water, then it was very, very easy with a chisel affair to just fit solidly down into the marks that you had made, and it would break off the cakes. You might break off a string of cakes, 6 or 8 feet, 6 or 8 cakes in a row. You would guide those to a point from which you're going to pull them out of the water. Now, this was done in several different ways, but the easiest way and the first way until you got your field wide open was by means of an ice tong, a long-handled ice tong. You would float the cake of ice up near the edge of the opening, just tip the back end down, the front end up, and you'd grab it with the ice tongs, and the buoyancy of the cake, you know, would just push it up out of the water with a little boost. Out it would come up onto the surface of the lake. And you would slide that cake off to a loading point, which might be on the shore or it might be even on the lake if the ice was thick enough to support a team with a sleigh or a wagon filled with ice. In that case, you needed to have pretty thick ice. Ice had to be, I'd say, not less than 12 inches thick, certainly, and probably 14, 16, up to 18 inches thick.
Now, you said 18 inches thick. Did you have to test for that thickness?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, how did you do that?
Well, you just chop a hole in the lake most anywhere and say, how thick is the ice? Do you think it's thick enough? Sure. So you measure the thickness of the ice somewhere on the lake. You had to be careful that you were not working in a place on the lake where there was a current underneath, which might result in a thinner layer of ice in one place than another, but you knew your lake. After all, I mean, you've done this every year for the last 1,000 years, so you know the lake. So once you've determined the ice is thick enough, you go ahead. Now the ice was, of course, now we have the ice field open, and we were beginning to take cakes out of it up on top of the ice, perhaps shoving them over to the shore or just lifting them by hand, two men lifting the cakes of ice up into the wagon or the sleigh, until you have the sleigh or wagon filled, and off you go to the ice house.
How were these men dressed in?
These men were dressed warmly, believe me. One of the things that has disappeared from the scene, I haven't seen any of these for 40 years, I don't think, was an outfit called Felt Boots. Felt, F-E-L-T, boots. You wore something like a stocking, a large stocking made of felt, and it was thick. And over the foot of this stocking affair was a good heavy rubber boot, therefore felt boots. They were very, very warm. They were very, very heavy, very, very clumsy. You plopped around with these things on, but they were warm, and that was essential. Because you worked out on the lake in terrible weather conditions. It was necessarily cold. You couldn't work out on the lake if it was raining on a warm rainstorm, for example. No work could be done. So it had to be cold, usually crisp and cold, and usually with about a 40-mile wind blowing, as I remember. And the upper clothing, of course, was good old long-handled underwear and good heavy clothing, heavy jackets and heavy mittens, usually mittens, not gloves, because mittens are so much warmer on the fingers than gloves. If you wore gloves, your fingers would freeze probably. So most everybody wore mittens and felt boots. That was before the days with L.L. Bean's beautiful outdoor
such thing.
Also, incidentally, these boots were terribly slippery on the bottom, and that necessitated wearing what we used to call crampons, which was a serrated blade which strapped right around the foot of the boot, and it gave you some traction.
How do you spell that?
C-R-A-M-P-O-N-S, crampons. That's what we call it anyway. I think that was the proper name. But that gave you some traction on the ice. Without it, you could even slip and fall. If you weren't careful, you fell in the water. But anyway, as I said at the beginning, icing was a brutal, brutal, hard work done under the worst possible weather conditions. Now we have the ice in the sleigh or the wagon. We haul it off to the ice house. I'm speaking of the Taconic area now. And in the Taconic area, we had about five ice houses which had to be filled. The Scoville had the large ice house, which is still standing up in Taconic. And Grassland Farms had a large ice house. Then there were about three other private ice houses around which had to be filled. While you're at it, you fill the whole bunch of them. Of course, you stuck with it as long as the weather held until the ice was all in. And these ice houses, of course, you started on as level a floor, sawdust floor, as you could possibly get in the ice house. So it required a little labor in there to take out the old ice that had been left from the season before, throw that out, and get a nice level surface on which to place the first layer of ice. If you didn't have a nice level surface, you ran into trouble later on because your ice would be going up and down and so forth. So the ice houses had a good floor of sawdust, which had probably been there for years, probably 2 or 3 feet of sawdust on the bottom. And around the edges of the ice houses was left a space of about 12 to 18 inches, which of course was filled with sawdust. And this had an insulating effect that very efficiently kept the ice from one season to the other. In the one particular Scoville ice house that I worked in many times, it was built on the side of a hill, so you had a lower door and an upper door. You started at the lower door and filled it as high as you could push the case of ice until you got about 10 or 12 layers. Then you moved to the upper doors, and where you could just slide them down onto those layers and probably build another eight or 10 layers. So you probably wound up with 15 to 18 layers of ice. The ice house itself was about 40 by 40. So that required a few thousand cakes of ice. That was the biggest one.
Were the ice houses built, so to speak, like a cave in the side of the hill?
No, this particular one was a brick ice house, a brick building just built into the side of a hill. And it was quite high from the bottom side of the hill. It must have been 20 feet high. And from the upper side, of course, it was only about a 10 or 12 feet height. But most of them were built level with the ground.
Were there any where you dug into the ground?
Oh, you would dig in no further than you would go for the ordinary foundation of the building. Uh-huh. No, there was no. I understand what your question is. Probably wanted to get down so they were further insulated by the earth. But I never saw it done that way. No, it's just ordinary construction with a good solid concrete foundation and a good, nice, wide open, solid door. Also, in the top of these buildings was a little ventilation. Strangely enough, it seemed to help preserve the ice if you had a little ventilation at the top of the buildings. But men were so used to this operation, and it was amusing because every year the same man led the same horse and the same plow, and the same man was always back there guiding it with his handles on, with handles like a plowshare. It seemed like that every man had his job and knew exactly what he was to do. And so it was quite efficient. Efficient, but as I said before, brutally hard. Hard labor required the lifting of these cakes. It's no great deal for two men to get a hold of a cake of ice and lift it up into a wagon or a sleigh. But when you stand there and do it 8 or 10 hours a day, after a while those cakes get very, very heavy and you get weary, you get tired, we did get a break. We used to have an hour for lunch, and that was necessary too.
And how long was the work day?
Well, we worked not less than 8 hours, but there are many 10-hour days. 10-hour days were rather customary back in those days. My father worked 11 hours. He worked from 7 in the morning till 6 at night. He was an hour off for lunch. That was a 10-hour day. Mm-hmm. And he did this for 40 years or more, as I can remember. And that was customary. The 8-hour day was a picnic, really.
When it finally came
about. 8-hour day was a piece of cake. Unless you have any further questions about the ice.
Well, I'd like to a couple of questions. One is the men who worked on the ice meant that they were working in the winter. What was the rest of their year's work? What kind of work did they do?
Well, some men who were without a job, for example, carpenters who back in those days found it very hard to work throughout the whole year, well, they would help out with the icing. But mainly the people who got on the ice were the typical people who worked on the farm and did the rest of the farm work the rest of the year. So they had a full year of work. But there were some people, as I said, painters perhaps and carpenters, mm-hmm. who found it difficult to work throughout a hard winter. They would say, well, if you need any help today, I'll give you a hand. But for the main part, it was the all-year crew.
Now, none of this work, of course, was for boys. I mean, you really needed men these jobs.
No, I don't remember really boys. I worked at it probably from age 14, if you call that a boy.
In those
days, 14-year-olds were men. Mm-hmm. Did men's work, yeah. At least most of the work.
The other question I have in mind is, as I presume, like our community or other communities in the United States are made up of different nationalities, different religious groups, and so on. What was the ethnic nature, at least, of the people who worked on this?
In this particular area, in that particular type of job, there was a very mixed group of men. I don't think in this particular area, I don't think there was any ethnic number over any other ethnic number. When it got to the charcoal industry, subject on which I spoke a few years ago, that was different. That was largely French in this particular area. Many French people came over into this area, and they just naturally gravitated to the charcoal industry.
You mentioned that was something they had done in the particular town. Most of them came from in France?
They came from France to this town, to Salisbury and Sharon, and most of them came from a particular small village in France. I suppose the way that happened was one or two came over here and found work in the charcoal industry, and they immediately wrote back to France and said, come on over, there's all the work you need here in the charcoal industry. So one after another came over. So I could think of six or eight or 10 families who all came from that particular area who wound up in the charcoal industry.
Now the ice workers then would include people who may have lived here a few hundred years, right? And would include new immigrants coming from various areas.
Oh yes. I would think that the ethnic makeup of those people who worked on ice were largely the same as the people who live here today. Mm-hmm. I can't determine any particular preponderance of one nationality over another.
Were there any difficulties in terms in relation to immigrants, language difficulties in work or anything like that?
No, at least not in the town of Salisbury. I never heard any other language other than English spoken in the town of Salisbury to any extent. That is not true where you have a large group of Italian people. And you only have to go over the border over to the town of Canaan, and you will find something entirely different, where you have many Italian families. And even today, you'll find Italian being spoken in many families in Canaan, not in Salisbury, not in my lifetime.
I was told in one interview that in Lime Rock, on the hill, which is on the other side of where the furnace is in Lime Rock,
yes,
that there were tents there and a great number of French people who worked in the ore industry there.
Yes.
Who used to sing songs at night and have bonfires and so on.
I'm sure that is true, and I think you would find that those people were closely related to the people who worked in the charcoal. The two, after all, are very closely allied. And I would think that these are the same people, same different families of the same group that you're referring to. I think that's probably absolutely true. And that was really true up on Mount Riga and Mount Washington area. They did get together and sing French songs and so forth. But I'll tell you a peculiar thing. Most French people, when they came over here, became very determined Americans. In my own family, for example, my father wouldn't permit French to be spoken in his home, except for a short, brief length of time. So none of the children grew up speaking French. They might know a few words, but it was a sad thing that we didn't learn two languages, because my father became all American, and he insisted on English being spoken. As a result, he spoke very good English and read avidly and was a self-educated man, a self-American-educated man. Again, I say that's not necessarily true among the Italians. They seem to retain their national flavor, I think, much longer than many other nationalities.
Now, the people who came from France, just occurs to me, would have come here subsequent to the French Revolution. In other words, 10 years, 15 years, 18 years, and would they have brought any of those traditions with them?
It's true. Some came after the French Revolution, some came before. My father was born in 1858, and he came over here in 1872,
yes,
at the age of 14.
Yes.
So he was not terribly affected by the effects of the Revolution. Strangely enough, most of the French people who came over here were Protestant. They're Huguenot origin, and which is contrary to France, which is about 80% Catholic. But just about all the people who came over here were Huguenots and Protestants.
Do you happen to know why they wanted to leave France to come here?
I don't know any particular reason, except that at that time people had heard of America because of the Revolution, and they knew that it was building at a tremendous rate. And I'm sure they said to themselves, we can find a spot for ourselves, a life for ourselves in America. America was a magic word back in those days. As it is today, we fondly hope. But I don't know of any single reason except this terrible urge to go to America. The fact that there was plenty of work here,
yes,
work for everyone, I think, was the real drawing card, probably.
All right. Well, let's take a look at some of the other areas of work in the area.
Yes, I find it interesting, and it's almost unbelievable that today people don't fully understand or realize how hard people worked just a mere 50 or 60 years ago. Almost any phase of work was done largely by hand. There were no machines to speak of. Sure, there was a mowing machine to cut down the hay, and a rake, a horse-drawn rake, to rake it up into windrows, and so forth. Let's speak about the hay business. That was probably the lightest work of all on the farm, and the most enjoyable. As I said, the hay was necessary for the cows to survive, so that was stored in large barns, loose, I might say. Today, almost all hay is baled, but back in those days, as far as I can remember, I never saw bales of hay put in. It was always put in loose, which necessitated the following operations. First, the hay was cut down, mowed with a mowing machine. And those mowing machines had a series of blades that ran back and forth. Those blades had to be sharpened by hand. That was every morning before he went out to the hay field. Those blades had to be good and sharp. So now the hay is cut down, it lies there, and then I suppose you're going to get some rain on it. So you have to leave it there another day until it dries. Then you have a little sunshine come out, so you go out with a horse-drawn rake, and you rake it up into windrows, which is a long heap in more or less straight lines left on the field. Well, the next operation was an operation for which there was no machine to do it that I ever saw. That was called cocking the hay. Cocking. Cocking, C-O-C-K-I-N-G, cocking. You heard of a haycock?
Yeah.
Well, a haycock. You went down the windrows with a fork, a hay fork, and you piled the hay into a haycock, which was of a convenient size, so that you could thrust the fork into the haycock and lift it up onto the hay wagon. The haycock had to be at just about a certain size. So you made the haycock that certain size, you lifted it up on the wagon, and you put it on the wagon where the driver said to put it. He had a fork in the wagon. He said, here, put it here, put it there, put it here, put it there. So they got a nice level layer of hay on the big hay rick, which was a wagon with a large wooden platform on it. And he was very fussy how you put the hay on the wagon, because you had a little rough territory to go over between there and the barn. If it wasn't put on the hay rack properly, the stuff might slide off, and then you're in trouble. So he said, put it there, put it there. Every man that pitched the hay onto that rack, he knew what he was doing exactly. And the man that was on the wagon, he knew exactly where he wanted it. So he didn't have to say much. He put his fork down, he knew where he wanted the hay. So that's where he put it. Then you took your fork, cleaned up the wisps of the hay left from the haycock, threw it up there. So these things were built up to the height of at which a man could reach up to the top of a load of hay. And those hay loads were pretty big. So you had to be rather agile and familiar with the job to lift the hay up on your fork and push up over your head as high as you could push it. Then the man on the load of hay would sort of grab it with his fork and pull it a little bit and put it where he wanted. As soon as you had your hay rack filled, he'd say, okay, come on up. So the two or three men who were pitching hay up onto the wagon would get up on the load, and they would sort of hold it down in places so that it would compress the hay so it would be less apt to fall off as you went over these rough spots. Sometimes I've seen a whole load of hay fall off, and it was a terrible job to put it back on the wagon again. So now you proceeded from the hayfield to the barn, and the hay was put into what was called a hay mow, which is the upper, over the top of the cow barn usually, which was a pretty high arrangement. So then that we had a fork, what was called a hay fork, which was an automatic tool with two big fingers that came down and grasped a load of hay off the hay rack, and it was hoisted up on a rope and pulled into the barn and dumped. Now the worst job in all of that was what we called mowing the hay, mowing away the hay. The hay was dumped in front of the large window in front of the barn. That hay had to be, somehow or other, had to be gotten into the rearmost portions of the hay mow. And that was done by people who could stand dust from the hay and heat up to about 125 or 30 degrees in the top of the barn, which was hotter than all get out. And I can remember my father was not a very big man, but he always seemed to be the guy who had to mow the hay away. And it was a hot, dusty job. And I often felt that he did this for one particular reward. It seemed to me that at the end of the day, when all the hay was brought in from the hayfield, brought to the barn and mowed away, somebody would be outside the barn with a great big pitcher of ice-cold ginger beer. I don't know what ginger beer was made of, but I suspect it was water, ginger, and a little bit of vinegar, because it was a tart and yet hot, and maybe a little sugar because it was tart and sweet, but it was a very refreshing drink, and everybody would stand there and drink that ginger beer and get a little life back into their bodies. But that was what hay was. It was a lot of fun, really. Hard work in some parts of it, but it was the easiest of all the farm operations, I guess. So that about covers hay. We cover icing.
Yeah.
So we could probably go on to...
Are you going to talk about harvesting corn?
Oh, yes, harvesting corn. Well, from the outside looking in, harvesting corn wouldn't seem to be such a terribly hard job. But corn, the ensilage corn, cow corn so-called, is not your average sweet corn. It's much larger, it's taller, it's half as big as the thickness of your wrist at the bottom. It's 8 to 10 feet tall, and one corn stalk by itself is heavy. So we did have a machine which cut the corn and laid it down and tied it into bundles of 6 or 8 stalks. Now you have 6 or 8 corn stalks laid down on the ground and tied with a harvest twine, which was done by the machine that cut the corn. Almost invariably, you're out in the field on a wet, we're speaking now of September, and the dew or whatever rain you had the night before or even that morning was heavy on the corn. The corn itself was heavy. And before you had worked in the cornfield for 15 minutes, you were wet from head to foot. And it could be quite cool on a September morning. The corn had to be lifted from the ground and thrown up onto a wagon similar to a hay wagon. You couldn't lift it as high as you did the hay because it was much too heavy. But you probably had 6 or 8 layers of these sheaves of corn thrown up onto the wagon. And it took a pretty strong man to take one of these bundles of corn and throw it up on the wagon, with the length of the corn being, as I said, 8 to 10 feet tall. And it was a hard, hard job. The corn was then hauled away on the wagon to the to the silo where it was then pulled off the wagon and put into an Esledge cutter, which ran down a chute to the Esledge cutter itself, which chopped it up and blew it up a chute into the top of the silo, up and down into the silo. Now this particular job was not terribly hard to take it off the wagon and put it on the chute and run it in through the Esledge cutter, but it was a very dangerous one. And I know of one occasion where a man's arm was pulled into this Esledge cutter, and he got it out just in time, and his hand and wrist were gone. But that happened, I would say, probably hundreds of times every year throughout the whole corn-producing area where you produced corn for Esledge. Very, very dangerous job. Farm equipment back in those days, and still today, is a very dangerous type of equipment. You had to be watching yourself every moment. Your hand or your arm or your leg could be pulled into one of these machines, and that was all she wrote. So that pretty well deals with harvesting corn, unless you can think of any other questions.
Let's go back to the wood cutting.
Wood cutting. Now you're speaking of, you're not speaking of wood cutting for the charcoal industry now. You're speaking of wood cutting for domestic use.
Right.
Well, I can speak about wood cutting two major uses for wood. Involves wood cut to about 2.5 to 3 feet lengths, and probably 15 or 18 to 22 inches in length. The shorter lengths would be used for fireplace wood, and most houses had fireplaces. And there was a great need for fireplace wood, although at that time many houses were beginning to be heated with coal. But a lot of people depended on fireplace wood for heat. Also, on the Scoville estate over at the Grassland Farms, they heated the barn with hot water, and hot water was produced from a quite a large furnace, which used 3 foot lengths of wood. You opened a big door into the maw of that furnace, you heaved these 3 foot lengths of wood, which were quite heavy. The wood had been, of course, split into sections. You couldn't put a whole log in there. But getting the wood itself...
Did they already have piping then?
Grassland Farms had piping. And one of the first hot water systems that I ever saw was in the Grassland Farms area. That didn't go into the cow barn section because the cows themselves produced enough heat to, you know, to keep themselves warm. But there are various bits of machinery around there that had to be protected from the cold. And so there was a little hot water system there in the immediate vicinity of the furnace. Over at the Scoville estate proper, you had an entirely different thing. You had a large, large greenhouse consisting of 6 or 8 separate little greenhouses by themselves, all connected. And these greenhouses were all heated by steam heat or hot water. Actually, it was steam, but it required the same amount of piping for steam heat. And this steam heat was produced by, again, a large furnace in the cellar of the greenhouse area. And that also took 3 foot lengths of wood. Well, those 3 foot lengths of wood just don't grow at hand. You have to go get them. So we had probably 50 or 100 acres of woodland about a half mile from the greenhouse area. So every year, after all the outside chores had been done and we got a lot of snow on the ground, it got good and cold, we went into the woods to cut wood. Normally, we selected either downed trees or dead trees to cut. Well, today, the fellow tree, you can fell a large tree in 2 or 3 minutes with a chainsaw. Nobody ever had heard of a chainsaw back in those days. So the first thing you did was select your tree. You selected the direction in which you wanted to drop the tree. You notched the tree in a peculiar manner so that when the tree was felled, that's where it would fall. Now again, I get back to my father, who was very, very handy with an axe. When he chopped into a tree, the resulting notch that he chopped was so smooth you would swear it was cut by a saw. He was so accurate with the blade of that axe. Of course, nobody, every man had their own axe. They sharpened it, they took care of it, and nobody else touched it. That was his private axe. So, now we get back to the tree. The tree was notched in such a manner that it would fall where you wanted it to fall. If it didn't fall where you wanted it to fall, it might fall into another tree and not fall at all. That's what we used to call hanging it up. Well, if you hanged a tree up, you were in hot water and you were in great trouble, because once you hung a tree, it was very, very difficult to get it loose and get it down again. But anyway, my father normally would, this involves the years that I worked in the woods, he would normally notch the tree. And it got so that someone would go out a little distance away from the tree and stick a little stick in the ground and say, this is where the tree is going to fall. And invariably, you'd fall it very, very close to that spot. After the tree was notched, then you took a cross-cut saw, which was about 4 to 5 feet in length. Some were actually 6 feet, with a handle on each side. Now, when you're cutting a tree down, it's a lot different, a lot harder than it is to cut it up, if you know what I mean. In order to cut it down, you hold the saw horizontally, necessarily, because the tree is vertical. But now you bend over and you're in a horrible, uncomfortable position.
Now you're talking about two men, right?
I'm talking about two men, one on either end of the saw. And you may be sawing a tree that's 18 inches in diameter. You might be sawing down a tree that is 3 feet in diameter. And again, it may not sound like much, but you, when you are on one end of a crosscut saw and you saw through a 2 foot or a 3 foot diameter tree, it involves a lot of sawing. And I have to go out and back to my father all the time. He was short. He was about 5'8", and built close to the ground. And he could outsaw any man I ever saw in that position, this horizontal position. It was terrible. It used to break my back, and I'd be out of wind in no time, and he'd say, come on, let's get it going. So anyway, now we saw the tree down. It falls where it's supposed to fall. It's on the ground. The first thing you do is limb the tree. Chop off all the limbs with your axe and haul them away to a pile where you're later going to burn them. Burn the branches. If the branches are large enough, you save them for firewood. But if they're small branches, you haul off and throw in a pile. Now you cut the logs to the required length. If you're going to use it for 3 foot wood for the furnace, you would probably cut it into 6 foot lengths. If you're going to cut it for 18 inch wood for fireplace, you'd probably cut 2 18 inch lengths or 3 feet, 3 feet and 3 feet and a half. So now you have the tree down on the ground, you have it cut up into the required lengths of the necessary sizes. Now you have to split the sucker. Again, there was no such thing as a log splitter. You split that log with wedges and hammers. rather sharp on one side and blunt on the other. You insert that into the either the end of the tree or the top of the tree, and you hammer them in until the thing finally splits. And you may hammer it, and sometimes if the wood is very springy, like you get an oak tree that's very springy, you might get four or five wedges in it that still haven't split. Then you're in trouble. So you might have to make a wood wedge that's thicker. Hammer it down in there, hammer and hammer away till it finally splits. If you get it down to the sizes where you can handle it, and you don't have any loaders, you load them by hand. You bend down there and you pick that thing up and you throw it up onto the wagon or sleigh. Again, this is brutal hard work, and yet there was a lot of fun connected with it. The first thing we'd go in the morning, which might be 10 or 20 below zero, we'd make a big bonfire so we could warm our hands and our wedges, incidentally. If the wedges were not warm, they'd pop right back out of the tree when you tried to hammer them in. They'd come out like a shot. So your wedge had to be warm. So you loaded up the sleigh and away you went with a load of wood and took it down to the area near the greenhouse, where then you either sawed it by hand, cut it up into the required lengths, or you cut it with a circular saw, with a saw about 36 inches in diameter, driven by probably an old Fordson tractor with a big belt on it. That thing would go 90 miles an hour and whistle in the air, and you stood there and you sawed these things up into the proper length. Again, a most dangerous job. I once saw one of these circular saws while going at full speed, and the man who had put the log on the saw table didn't have it at quite the right angle, and the saw split. It disintegrated probably 15 different pieces, revolving at a tremendous rate. It threw the pieces straight up in the air and for quite a distance. Any one of those pieces could have dismembered the person that had it hit them. As it was, I remember the fellow's name was Bill Reed, when the saw exploded, the only man that was hurt was he got a little piece of the saw lodged in his nose. Which sounds funny, but it could just as well have hit the eye. So it lodged into the tough part of his nose. He didn't know it was there. We saw blood running down his face, so finally somebody reached up, took the piece of the saw and pulled it out of his nose. But that, again, wood was a necessary thing required for heat, and everyone did it. It came as natural as breathing. In the wintertime, you got in ice, you got in wood. In the fall of the year, you got in corn. In the summer, you got in hay. This briefly is some of the types of work that I have seen done as a young man, and this goes back to, from, let's say, 1919 to the early 30s, this type of work was done. Even the late 30s, I was more or less involved in it now and then in all these phases.
You mentioned one other area, the building trades.
Oh, the building trade is interesting. Today, everything is done with power tools. The average carpenter, he's able to drive a nail fairly straight. But in the old days, I call them, almost everything was done with a hand saw. Beams were cut with a handsaw, and those beams had to be cut straight,